backed up all the way to the street and had a big crowd out front. Well, I'm glad who's here is here. And I know God is glad too that you've come out to worship him and to honor him, our great creator. There are a lot of passages in the Bible that provide us with a great deal of comfort, build up our faith and our trust and our confidence in God. For example, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. My favorite's in Ephesians 3:20, that he's able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think. Sometimes these are referred to as refrigerator verses. It might be something that you stick on the refrigerator with a magnet. Over the years, I've had a practice of either printing out or writing down on a piece of paper a verse or two, and I'll stick it in my pocket. And I'll pull that verse out during the day, read it, try to memorize it, think about it, and so forth. One verse that I used a lot, I actually printed it out with the computer, and I went to where I was working, and we had the equipment, and I laminated it so that I could carry it in my pocket. I felt it was so important, and this is the verse. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape that you may be able to bear it. Very familiar verse with most of us, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. I think this verse is an extremely important verse, so I decided I'm going to have a lesson devoted entirely to this verse, and I've entitled the lesson, No Temptation Has. Well, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 can teach us a lot of lessons. It can teach us lessons, important lessons, about temptation. One lesson it teaches us about temptation is that temptation is something that is inevitable. Certainly true that we're in the world, but as Christians, we're not to be of the world. Yet the world is filled with temptation, the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life, 1 John 2, verses 15 to 17. Satan is a busy person, isn't he? He works 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, never takes a day off. Just like Christians aren't supposed to, as we talked about this morning. Peter says he walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. If you've ever seen a nature show, how do those lions operate? They're constantly on the prowl, aren't they? Looking for their next victim, and that's exactly what Satan is like. Paul said that Satan is when he told us to take up the whole armor of God in Ephesians chapter 6, what is the reason for doing that? One of the reasons is that we might be able to withstand the wiles of the devil, the schemes of the devil. He's a schemer. He's a thinker. He's a plotter, if you will. He's constantly thinking of his next move in order to get us to succumb to temptation. He's also powerful, especially in the sense that he has the whole world at his beck and call. So he has a lot of help. In 1 John 5 and verse 19, John said, the whole world lies under the sway of the wicked one. So all of the people in the world are, in essence, his helpers. And of course, it talks about the devil and his angels in passages like Matthew 25 and verse 41 and 2 Peter 2 and verse 4, Jude 6, and so forth. So he has a lot of help as he seeks to deceive us, as he seeks to get us to fall away. So he's forever plotting and scheming to come up with what he believes is going to be the best plan of attack that's going to lead him to success. He knows, as we might say, for each of us, what button to push, doesn't he? And if a certain button doesn't work any longer, what does he do? He moves on to another button, doesn't he?
Yes, sir.
It says, now, when Jesus was tempted, it says, now when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him. Was that the end of it? So, until a more opportune time. So he went back to headquarters, or whatever we might want to say, and he plotted for the future. He tried to dream up some other way to tempt Christ. So Satan is no joke. We should never make jokes about the devil or Satan, because if we do that, we'll take him lightly and underestimate his. Well, another thing we can learn about temptation is that my temptations, your temptations, are not unusual temptations. I'm using that word a lot, but it's a temptation in and of itself that when Satan is really bearing down on us, to think that we're going through something that someone else has never went through. And that's just not true. What does 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 say? No temptation has overtaken you such as what is common to man. So, in some sort of a way, it should give us a measure of comfort and strength to know that whatever I'm going through, whatever you're going through, other people have went through that before. Not everybody's made it through without sinning, but someone has. So, after telling us about Satan as a roaring lion in 1 Peter 5 and verse 9, he says, resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood. In other words, you're not going through something unusual. Somebody's been through this before. So, we have to be very careful when we're being tempted to not think that, well, this is just, nobody knows what I'm going through. And we're tempted to have what I would call a personal pity party at that point, aren't we? And that just gives Satan another opportunity to bring us down. And we just can't afford to do that. The wise man said in Proverbs 17 and verse 22, a merry heart does good like medicine, but a broken spirit dries the bones. If we get down and start feeling sorry for ourselves, we put ourselves in even more danger. So, our temptation is not unusual. Then amazingly, temptation serves a useful purpose. You might want to underscore that, useful. Temptation can be useful to us. First of all, through temptation, we can gain God's approval. In James 1, verse 12, James says, blessed is the man. Which man? The man who endures temptation. For when he has been approved, that's when he's successfully gotten through the temptation without sinning, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him. The Lord is cheering us on to get through the temptation. Even though I didn't put it in the sermon, it just dawned on me. What's the point of Hebrews chapter 11? It's to give us courage to make it through temptation, to not let that sin that so easily ensnares us, ensnare us. Well, another useful purpose temptation serves is it purifies our faith. Turn over to 1 Peter chapter 1. Peter says that temptation purifies our faith. In verse 6, in this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, you have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ, whom, having not seen, you love. Though now you do not see him, yet believing, you rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, receiving the end of your faith, the salvation of your souls. I worked in a factory at one time in my life for 3 years, and that made bearings in that factory, all the way from that size to this size, huge bearings. And one thing that all of those bearings had in common, the components that went into making them had to go through a heat treating process. They had to be heated up to like 1800 degrees for certain period of time. It was a trial by fire. And what did it do? It made them harder. It made them able to withstand all of the friction that they were going to go through. And it purified them in that sense. And that's what temptations do for us. And then thirdly, temptation builds our hope. In Romans chapter 5 and verse 3, Paul said, "We also glory in tribulations, knowing that tribulation produces patience, and patience produces perseverance, and perseverance character, and character hope." Well, another lesson that we can learn from 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 about temptation is that we have to be ready for temptation. We've already established that temptation is inevitable, and it's a common condition for man, and it serves a useful purpose. So only a fool would deny those great truths. But we have to exercise what I would call due diligence. I worked a lot in the financial world, and if you are an accountant or something like that, you have to exercise due diligence to make sure that you're prepared, that you get things right. And that's what we have to do in regards to temptation, that we're always ready to deal with it. And I have some strategies here that we can use. We have to exercise sobriety and diligence. Be sober, be vigilant, Peter says, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion whom he may devour. Now, Vine defines sober as it signifies to be free of intoxicants. Oh, preacher, you just want to slip it in here about alcohol. Well, alcohol is not the only thing that can affect our judgment, but alcohol certainly, and we know how that works. Why did David want to get Uriah? Why did he give him some alcohol? He wanted to affect his judgment, didn't he? So we have to be sober. We have to be on the lookout. In regards to alcohol, I always remember this line from True Grit. If you remember the young girl in that was the main character, the sheriff offers her a drink of whiskey, and she says, "I wouldn't put a thief in my mouth to steal my brains." And I've always remembered that line. It's a good one. So we need to be sober and diligent and watchful. 1 Peter 4:7, be serious and watchful in your prayers. Some other passages, Revelation 3 and verse 2 and so forth. If you're aware of self-defense, if you've ever taken a class in self-defense, or I bet Al has learned this in the Army, situational awareness. You've heard that terminology. Means that whatever place you're at, you need to be aware of your surroundings. Where is potential danger coming from? And Satan is that roaring lion. He's there lurking in the shadows somewhere. So we need to have this sense of situational awareness. We also have to be aware of our own personal danger zones. I know sometimes I have a problem with my temper. And I most easily lose my temper when I'm really tired. And when I'm really tired, my arthritis gets to bother me a lot. And so I'm hurting at the same time. And I have to talk with myself when I'm in that condition that be careful. You're in the danger zone. It doesn't take much to set me off in that position. But not only be watchful, we need to put up a fight. Again, from 1 Peter 5, that roaring lion idea, in verse 9, Peter goes on to say, resist him steadfast in the faith. James says in James 4 and verse 7, resist the devil and he will flee from you. Doesn't mean he's not going to come back, but at least for that point in time, if we resist him, he's going to flee. We must also couple our resistance with obedience. Resistance alone isn't enough. And again, James 4 and verse 8, after saying resist the devil, the next verse says draw near to God and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. resist the devil, but then follow that up by drawing near to God. In 1 John 4 and verse 4, remember, the one that is in us, who is Christ, of course, is greater than he that is in the world. And then lastly, along that line, from Romans 13 and verse 14, make no provision for the flesh. Paul writes there, we're to put on the Lord Jesus Christ. Make no provision for the flesh to fulfill the lust thereof. In other words, put ourselves into a position where we try to get as close as we can to sin and think somehow that we're not going to go over the edge of the cliff. We're just setting ourselves up for trouble when we do that. Then another thing we can learn from 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 is it teaches us that God, or excuse me, I missed one, never underestimate Satan. It's a short point, so it was kind of hidden there. I missed it. Never underestimate Satan. I didn't think about this a whole lot until I was preparing this lesson. Satan was not afraid to take on the Lord Jesus Christ one-on-one. That takes a lot of courage, a lot of chutzpah, as we might say. He won one-on-one. He failed, but even when he failed, what did he do? He didn't give up. He's going to come back. It says, when he had ended every temptation, he departed from him until a more opportune time. He wasn't afraid to take him on. Even though he failed, he wasn't afraid to come back. Well, our next main point is God is no respecter of persons. We learned that from 1 Corinthians 10:13. No matter what some people might say, God is not our enemy. Ezekiel 33 and verse 11, God does not take delight in the death of the wicked. He doesn't want us to fail. The exact opposite is true. He wants everyone, from a spiritual standpoint, to succeed. He always has our best interests in mind. Remember Romans 8 and verse 32 in this regard. He who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for all of us, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? God is constantly there. He's like that father in the story of the prodigal. He's there waiting and hoping that we'll come to him. But unfortunately, a lot of people even blame God for their temptations. They do something wrong, they lose their temper or something like that. Well, that's just the way God made me. That's blaming it on God. God did not make us that way. In Ecclesiastes 7 and verse 29, God made man upright. He made all of us upright. But we have sought out many schemes. Furthermore, God doesn't single me out. He doesn't single you out when it comes to temptation. He only allows us to experience temptation that's common to all men. We've already talked about that. Always remember James chapter 1, beginning of verse 13. No man say when he's tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone? But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then, when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full blown, brings forth death. Do not be deceived. Think about it. If God tempted us, that would turn him into a cruel, evil monster, because if he tempted us, then he's going to potentially send us to hell for the very temptation that he sent our way. And all I can say to that is, God forbid. God would never do such a thing. Right. Do you remember what Jesus said about those who would tempt someone? He said it would be better if a millstone were hung around their neck and they were thrown into the sea. But we are certainly made of flesh, at least our body is. We live here in the temporary world that we live in. So we're subject to temptations, and they appeal to us through the lust of the flesh and so forth. And God calls us to deal with those situations. And he's there constantly willing to help us through. So we should never entertain either of these thoughts. Number one, that God has it out for us. Number two, that God is allowing me to be tempted somehow to a greater degree than he allows others to be tempted. That he does not do. The psalmist said in Psalm 84 and verse 11, "For the Lord God is a sun and shield. The Lord will give grace and glory. No good thing will he withhold from those who walk uprightly." Well, another lesson we need to learn from 1 Corinthians 10:13 is that God is faithful. I believe this is the very centerpiece of this verse. We can absolutely, positively count on him to keep his word. We're used to men not keeping their word. This was said by the President of the United States in October 1940. He said, "I have said this before and I will say it again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign wars." That's October 1940. Of course, we know, as Paul Harvey said, we know the rest of the story. This was said by the President of the United States in October 1964. "We're not about to send American boys 9 or 10,000 miles away from home to do what Asian boys ought to be doing for themselves." Well, I visited the Vietnam Memorial, and there's some 55,000 names of dead American boys that went to Asia, unfortunately. So that's no big truth, is it, that politicians don't tell the truth? But God always tells the truth. He's 100% totally and completely reliable. Throughout the Bible, for example, Lamentations 3:23, "Great is your faithfulness." Deuteronomy 7 and verse 9, "Know that the Lord your God, he is God, the faithful God who keeps covenants and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love him and keep his commandments." Paul simply states in 2 Thessalonians 3:3, "The Lord is faithful." In 2 Timothy 2 and verse 13, "If we are faithless, he remains faithful. He cannot deny himself." Then Titus 1 and verse 2, "God cannot lie." It's an impossibility. It's something that never enters the mind of God. It just cannot happen. No way, no how. You know, we take it for granted that the sun comes up every morning and sets every evening. I have never spent any time in my life worrying about, is the sun going to come up tomorrow? Is it really going to come up? Never had to worry about that. Never even entered my mind. But you know that someday the sun isn't going to come up. Some day is going to come when the sun doesn't set. But the day will never come when God is not faithful. "I change not," Jehovah said in Malachi 3 and verse 6. Of course, a verse very familiar with us, Hebrews 13 and verse 8. "He's the same yesterday, today, and forever." We can trust in God's faithfulness more than we can trust in the rising and the setting of the sun. And that being the case, we can trust his promises in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. Another thing that we can learn from this great verse is that God is in control. Nobody I know enjoys having chaos in their life. We all want stability. And God's ultimate instability. And this, again, goes back, at least in part, because we can totally, completely, and absolutely trust in him. He doesn't tempt us to sin. He will not do that. Furthermore, he's greater than the tempter. He exercises authority over the tempter. We alluded to it, I believe it was in the lesson or the Bible class this morning about, remember, Jesus talked about entering the strong man's house and plundering his goods. What did he have to do before he did that? He had to bind the strong man. And that's exactly what God has done insofar as Satan is concerned. God has limited Satan's power. For example, this was demonstrated in the book of Job. Satan accused God of building a hedge around Job where Satan couldn't get at him. And God partially removed that hedge, didn't he? But he limited Satan in that he couldn't do certain things. So that doesn't still mean that Satan isn't extremely powerful. All you have to do is look into world history and people like Hitler and Stalin and Mao. I believe they were agents of Satan. Satan was working through them and did terrible, awful, destructive things. So even though God's limited his power, he's still very powerful. But God is infinitely more powerful than Satan. The creation demonstrates God's power. I don't think Christians in general study the creation enough. The creation demonstrates the great power of God. I mean, if for example, this computer, if I brought this computer in and said, well, you know, I went to Radio Shack and went through there and I bought all these parts and pieces and I put them together and look, works. And let's say I really did that. I remember when I was working on my master's degree, this was before personal computers came out, one of the professors, interestingly, he taught physiology, but he was a genius in biomedical engineering. I went into his office one day and he was building a thing called a personal computer from scratch. Of course, at that time, I didn't have a clue what a personal computer was, but I was very impressed with that, and rightly so. But the very atoms that make up the parts in this personal computer, the Lord created them. And what's even more amazing, he called them into existence from nothing. He called this entire universe into existence from nothing. If he has that kind of power, surely he has the power to limit Satan's power, doesn't he? The resurrection demonstrates God's power. We talked about that this morning from Ephesians chapter 1. That's the power that's available to us. Read verses 16 to 20 in chapter 1 again. The power of the resurrection flows through the Christian if the Christian will allow that. And we can use that power to empower us to overcome temptation. He who is in us is greater than he who is in the world. 1 John 4 and verse 4. And then another lesson we can learn from 1 Corinthians 10:13 is God knows our limitations. Every one of us, when we buy a new car, we get an owner's manual, don't we? And it tells us how that automobile works. It also gives us the limits. For example, my Honda has a tachometer and it's got a place there where the tachometer turns red, and I know what that means. The manufacturers tell me, don't rev this engine up into that red part or you're going to cause some damage. They know the limits of it. When I was a flight instructor, it's even more so when it comes to airplanes. There's all kinds of warnings. In fact, the warnings are so important that the FAA requires airplane manufacturers to actually put placards inside the cockpit for various and sundry things. You're not to exceed this speed, for example, and other things. Whenever you do a cross-country flight, you had to be very careful to know exactly the weight of the passengers, the weight of the luggage, how much fuel was in it, how much fuel was in this tank, how much fuel was in that tank. And then there was a whole process you had to go through to make sure that the center of gravity of that airplane was not in a place that would get you into trouble. Because if the center of gravity is off, you can be in for some really serious problems. Well, think about God. God is our maker. He created us from the dust of the ground, created us in his image. He will never allow our engine to over-rev, to go into the red. He'll never allow us to reach the stall speed, for example, as an airplane does and falls out of the sky. He won't let that happen because he's never going to allow us to face a temptation that he knows we can't handle. We can just take that to the bank. We can see this principle demonstrated in the life of the Apostle Paul. For example, turn over to 2 Corinthians 11. Let's read all the things that Paul went through. But the Lord knew that he could handle that. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 24. From the Jews, five times I received 40 stripes minus one. The Lord knew he could handle that. Three times I was beaten with rods. The Lord knew he could handle that. Once I was stoned. Three times I was shipwrecked. A night and a day I have been in the deep. The Lord knew he could handle that. In journeys often, in perils of waters, in perils of robbers, in perils of my own countrymen, in perils of the Gentiles, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, the Lord knew he could handle that. In weariness and toil, in sleeplessness often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness. And despite all of that, what did he say at the end of his life? I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. Therefore, a crown of life is laid up for me that the righteous judge will give me. He talks about the thorn in the flesh in 2 Corinthians 12. Remember, he prayed three times that that thorn in the flesh, whatever it was, would be removed. It must have been very bothersome sort of a thing. But the Lord denied his request. Why? The Lord knew he could handle that. The Lord actually knew he needed that. In 2 Corinthians 12 and verse 9, what did the Lord answer to his three requests? The Lord answered this, my grace is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. Then Paul writes on, therefore, most gladly, I will rather boast in my infirmities that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities, in reproaches, in needs, in persecutions, in distresses, for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. The Lord knew exactly how much Paul could handle. He knew exactly how much he needed to handle. And the same is true with us. The Lord knows for each one of us how much we can handle and, very importantly, how much we need to handle. We need some adversity in our life to purify and strengthen our faith, as we've read from 1 Peter chapter 1. In James 1 and verse 2, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience. Perseverance, in verse 4, must finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. I can't remember the fellow and his son that were here this morning, but I heard them talking that the son was going to go out camping, and one of the things he was going to have to do was stay out in the woods all night by himself, make his own shelter, and there was very limited insofar as what he could take out there. That's a challenge. But when he goes through that challenge, what's that going to do for him? It's going to build his confidence. It's going to make him stronger. And that's what temptation does for us. 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13 also teaches us that God is our deliverer. God is not only faithful in allowing us not to be tempted beyond what we're able to handle, he's also faithful to provide a means of deliverance from every temptation. So we're fools to go it alone. Let's turn over to the 121st Psalm. It's a short one. The subtitle of this chapter is God is Our Keeper. I will lift up my eyes to the hills. From whence comes my help? Help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. See the importance of creation? He will not allow your foot to be moved. He who keeps you will not slumber. Behold, he who keeps Israel shall neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your helper or your keeper. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun shall not strike you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord shall preserve you from all evil. He shall preserve your soul. The Lord shall preserve your going out and your coming in from this time forth and evermore. Over and over again, we see that God is the great deliverer in the scriptures. God delivered Noah and his family from the evil world and the flood. He delivered Lot and his daughters from the terrible destruction that came on Sodom and Gomorrah. He delivered the Jewish people from Egyptian bondage. They were in a terrible situation. He delivered them from the Babylonian captivity. Remember, when they were in Babylon, he delivered them from the plot against the Jews that Haman foiled. Of course, remember the deliverance of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery furnace, and Daniel from the lion's den. Turn over to 2 Peter chapter 2. Peter uses the deliverance of Noah and Lot to make a critical point that we need to learn about temptation. In verse 4, Peter writes, "If God did not spare the angels who sinned, but cast them down to hell and delivered them into chains of darkness to be reserved for judgment, and did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people, a preacher of righteousness, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly, and turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemned them to destruction, making them an example to those who afterward would live ungodly, and delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked, for that righteous man dwelling among them tormented his righteous soul from day to day by seeing and hearing their lawless deeds." If God did all of that, delivered them, verse 9 is the point he's making, then the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. God judged the angels. He judged Noah's world. He judged the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, but he delivered the righteous. And he knows then how to deliver us from temptation. God provides deliverance from every temptation. But very importantly, we have to look for that way of escape. God doesn't tap me on the shoulder and whisper into my ear. I have to look for the way of escape. And then, as I look, I have to remind myself it's there somewhere. I'm guaranteed of that. And that being the case, then when I find it, which I will if I look for it with enough faith, I have to have the courage and the determination to take that way of escape. God warned Noah. God helped Noah. But Noah still had to pick up the hammer and the saw and so forth and build that ark, didn't he? Lot had to walk away from his home. The children of Israel had to walk out of Egypt. The Jews had to make that trip from Babylon, where they were living in relative comfort and ease, and go back where? To a ruined city. Imagine the thoughts and the feelings as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego approach that fiery furnace. I wonder if it went through their mind. Did we really make the right decision here? I'd have been a little scared at that point, because remember what happened to the men that threw them into the furnace? They were burned up. Think about Daniel, as he is thrown into the pit of lions. I've tried to imagine that in my mind. It must have been like some sort of a chute or something that went down to this place where these lions were, because when you read about when he's delivered out of there, they take his accusers and they throw them in that same place, and before they can get to the bottom of the lion's den, the lions had them and killed them. You imagine rolling down that chute and you get to the bottom and there's all these lions looking at you, and they're so close to you, you can feel their breath on your skin. What would be going through your mind? But they were convinced that God would deliver them, and God will deliver us from every temptation if we look. They were convinced in God's promises, and we need to be convinced when it comes to promises concerning temptation. We're not going to suffer any temptation that's not uncommon. We're not going to be tempted beyond our ability to endure it. God will always provide a way of escape, and then we'll be able to bear the whole thing. But we have to look and take that way of escape. And I would suggest to you at least three things that are involved in that. It requires us to have a knowledge of God's word. How did Jesus deal with temptation in the wilderness? He answered the devil three times with scripture. We have to be diligent in prayer. How did Jesus handle that awful temptation in the Garden of Gethsemane? He did so through prayer. And then we have to be sober, vigilant, and watchful. Now, those are some lessons that we can gain from 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. God has given us so many great and precious promises, and I don't think any of them is any greater than the promises of 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. No temptation has overtaken you, except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you're able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. Are you taking advantage of God's great and precious promises? If you're not, do so tonight. We encourage you as we stand and sing.
I am resolved no longer to linger, charmed by the world.